like to read to you from a letter that I wrote the other day to Phyllis Victory. Dearest Phyllis, you're in my thoughts and always in my heart and soul. God is so kind as to help us through the most difficult of times, and when we have come through them, then he gives us the full grace of his presence. How wonderful to be in business with God. Certainly we cannot help it when fear grips us, other than to hang on to the hem of Mother's robe. I think it can be properly said that she experienced everything we have had to go through. It makes my heart swell to think that she came to this earth with no karma of her own, that she went through all the experiences she did, often without a clue to her divine origin, in order to show us it can be done. Without that example, are we not forever condemned to our present fate? But when we see a soul move from the human to the divine, then we are inspired to do the same. This is my objection to the way Self-Realization Fellowship and Ananda have set up Master. One, they remove anything they may think of as his human traits, and then they set him up as an avatar. By their definition, he is beyond our ability to be lifted up to his heights. In this way, they set up barriers between ourselves and the infinite. Mother always made us feel as though we could become one with God, and she gave us glimpses of that through Guru Shakti. One's reverence to the Master is automatic and does not need to be dramatized through distortions and deletions of the truth. How could they think that this will serve Master and the truth he came to teach? It is delusive and only creates confusion. With Kriyananda, you know his students treat him as guru without the title. I have seen at SRF the people have pictures of Dayamata in their visors of their car. In their hearts, she is their guru, again without the title. So confusion reigns. Also, what is the purpose of hiding the human in Master? Are they ashamed of him? We, of course, know how difficult it was to be with Mother during her years of hardship, much less how hard it could be for us to encounter her humanity any time of our knowing her. But what great lessons we garnered from those times. I remember once during Mother's last year, she would wonder if she would ever get married again, and how much she missed having a partner to share her life. Such a human desire from a totally divine consciousness. But the lesson I learned was to become less afraid of who I was. I did not have to put on a spiritual persona for the world, because who I was on a human level was not acceptable. This kind of deception does not help the aspirant or any of those who are part of their life. What blessings Mother brought to us, not only teaching us of the highest mystical truths, but she gave openly as a human being in her example of the highest manifestation of God. What Papa calls para-bhakti. This state is beyond bhakti, or love of God, and beyond jnana, knowledge of God beyond creation. It is a manifestation of sat, impersonal truth of being, and prakriti, expression of sat through form. Who could imagine such wonders? Who could know in the beginning such subtle truths and be able to identify blunders made by some teachers? What grace brought us to this path where we could be blessed by one who is totally human and divine? No reason the human mind can explain this blessing of being with Mother and that truth. But deep in my heart comes the gratitude, indeed the eternal gratitude, of the awareness to stand at the foot of a great mountain and appreciate it. How much more the appreciation grows as we attempt to scale those heights. For the Master is always beckoning us to climb those heights. Their greatest wish is for us to see and experience what they have done. Each step we take is following their example. Therefore, it can truly be said, they are the way, the truth, and the light, and only through them can we enter into the kingdom of heaven. Every truly realized Master can rightfully make this proclamation. How wonderful to realize this great truth. How much greater to climb that mountain of consciousness and stand by their side, surveying all that God has brought into being, and then to become active participants with them in manifesting that vision in our lives and to all whom we come into contact. My love and prayer always, David. I'd like to read from a book entitled The Perfect Master, The Early Life of Meher Baba. A teacher who is a master of arts, but who wishes to teach alphabet to children, must of necessity bring himself down to their level. Then only can he be able to teach them, and step by step bring them to his level. If he does not come down from the heights of his attainments to their level, then all his labor for them will end in nothing. Similarly, a perfect master has to bring himself down to the level of his disciples, so that he may be able to impart his knowledge to them. He has also to take into consideration the circumstances in which he finds himself before doing anything. Take the case of the Arabian prophet. When he was harassed by his enemies and threatened by premature death, he actually fled from Mecca and took refuge in Medina. And by doing so, he acted just as an ordinary man when confronted with such an emergency. Madhubs cannot act like Salaks and Sadgurus, for they are so much drowned in the sea of divinity that they cannot have the slightest consciousness of their body. They cannot impart knowledge to others and show what truth is. On the same day in the evening, Baba, in the course of his discourse on spiritual light, observed, "There is, besides our two external eyes, one internal eye. The internal eye, which may be called the spiritual eye, really sees through the two external eyes and is located between the two eyebrows. Saints see God with the internal eye and the world with the external eyes. One generally passes through three stages in the spiritual life. The first stage is of burning enthusiasm, when the aspirant is imbued with the keen desire of seeing and experiencing the unknown. The second stage is of disgust and disappointment. The third is of divine bliss. The second stage, in which you are at present, is very long. Since you cannot escape from it or remedy it, you must put up with it cheerfully. Don't leave me in any case." What was that?
I said okay.
And from the Bhagavad Gita, "Who pass their days exempt from greed and wrath, subduing self and senses, knowing the soul, the saint who shuts outside his placid soul all touch of sense, letting no contact through, whose quiet eyes gaze straight from fixed brows, whose outward breath and inward breath are drawn, equal and slow through nostrils, still and close, that one, with organs, heart, and mind constrained, bent on deliverance, having put away passion and fear and rage, hath even now obtained deliverance, ever and ever freed." I would like to speak this evening on the three portals to deliverance. As Meher Baba explained this evening, there are those three portals that we must pass through in our obtaining the divine goal. When we first enter upon this path, if we are taken up by the divine current, then we feel that upliftment in body, mind, and soul. We feel drawn to God with everything in our being. Whether we can name what that is or not, or whether we are just intuitively guided towards that, every part of our being wants to measure up, wants to rise to the occasion. And we feel great passion at that time for the path and for deliverance. But there comes the time in every soul's development when they go through that time that is known as the dark night of the soul. It is during that time that that traditional way of knowing God that has been a presence in their life, that has been a movement within their soul, comes to a halt. They enter into as if a dark cave in which at the very end is a light which they can barely see. Now, there are many who lose faith at that time. They say, "'Tis hard, too hard to go through this," and they back away and enter back into the world. Or delusive thoughts take over, and they think to themselves, "This has all been a sham. Yes, I used to remember it. I used to believe in that. I used to think that I could attain something spiritual. But now I see that the world has many good things to offer. And why should I sacrifice myself for this when there are so many things of the world to enjoy?" And on go the different temptations, the different desire natures that begin to draw us back once again into the outward life. When we enter into the inner life, we are drawn there as if by a huge magnet. In the beginning, it may be a casual interest. We may be brought because somebody else has entertained us with some ideas or some thoughts of what we can attain there. But when we really catch fire with it, it burns brightly within us. We feel as if we are of a tremendous nature that is beyond our knowing. We come to believe that there is something beyond ourselves that we can attain to. Again, we may not have a name for it, we may not know what that is, but there is something that stirs deeply in us, an intuitive understanding that there is more to our life than just living day to day, earning our bread and having our children and raising them to retirement, going out and playing on a golf course in retirement and eventually growing old and die. Surely life must be made up of more than this. There must be more to our lives than this mundane way of viewing the world. And so this stirring begins to act upon us. And with each stirring comes a deeper call of the inner nature. We must have that inner call. If we do not, we are just on a mental trip. When we are just on a mental trip, we will dabble here and there. We will study a little bit of philosophy and a little bit of religion. And we will think, well, that is good. That's something that tends to ring true. And we remain satisfied with that. Or we will delve in a little deeper and we'll think, well, let me find the history, the roots of this. And so we will become interested in the historical or the philosophical origins of a different philosophy. But this is far deeper, or far different, than the deeper truth that calls to us. When we get that calling, we get a deep stirring within our own soul. We feel as if there is something that is lacking within us, and it is an inner urge to discover and explore what that deeper knowing, that deeper urge is. And unless we have that, we stay purely on a mental plane with it. And in order to transcend the mental plane, we respond and we move into that deeper place. Now, it may start out with just a question, who am I? Now, in the ordinary sense of things, we say, well, I have this body, I have a name, perhaps I have a profession, or I have a family that I come from, I have a nation that I belong to, I have a language that I speak, and so on and so forth. And these are all the outward facts that describe who I am. But when this deeper urge, this gnawing inside of us takes over, those things stop being satisfying. They stop being the answers that we seek. We want to know a deeper answer inside of us. Now, this urge creates an unrest in the soul. We are not as satisfied with the outer world. We are not as satisfied with knowing just who we are in the outer sense of things. We want to know on a deeper level. In order to pursue that, we must be willing to let go of our assumptions of who we have traditionally thought ourselves to be. That is, this body, these feelings that come and go, these thoughts that are transient. And we want to know the truth in such a way that it responds with the deepest knowing in our soul. We don't want just an intellectual answer. We don't want just to read somebody else's idea of how it is or who we are. We want, and more than that, need to experience the truth within our own beings. We should not be satisfied with just an intellectual understanding of these things. We should want to know it to the point that we are convinced, heart, mind, and soul, of the truth that is within our own being. So in the beginning, we start out with a question, or perhaps it is a deep yearning from the heart and from the feelings. We feel ourselves empty and that our lives are incomplete. But again, we may not know what the answer is. And that is almost by definition, we will not know what the answer is. Because until we have become that, we will not know what that is. When we start out on our educational path in kindergarten or in first grade, we first learn to read and to write, to start with arithmetic. There is no way for us to know what it is to finish a master's degree or a doctorate degree at a university level. And yet we must proceed through each one of the steps of education in order to arrive there. There is no getting around it. There is no subverting that process. And in the same way, in the spiritual path, we must begin where we are at. Now, you would not be drawn to these teachings unless you were ready for something greater. These teachings, as Mother has given it and the Masters before her, are focused on that last final mile. It is not for those who are in kindergarten. It is not for those who are just wanting to begin their understanding of these things. Now, true enough, we may feel like a child when we first come to this path. When I first met Mother, I had done some readings on the Eastern mysticism, on some different religions, but I wasn't interested in hearing about God or the concept of God. I wasn't very interested in, or even knowledgeable about what Christ was. In fact, I was one of those who, that if I heard the word God or Christ, I was usually looking for the nearest exit. I used to take some joy in taking up issue with those who believed in the Christian way, and I would argue with them. I was rather mischievous when I was in high school. I was working at my father's business, and there was two women who worked in close proximity with each other. And one was a Jehovah's Witness, and the other was, I think, just a freelancer in terms of a religion, but she had very strong and definite ideas on how things were. So I would present different philosophical issues to one, and I would get an answer, and oftentimes quoted with scriptures and all the rest of it. Then I would ask the other one, and they would give me some different answer, again, based on all the scriptures and quotations that they had in their armament. So then I would walk back to the first one and I say, well, do you know what the other lady said? And pretty soon they were talking to each other and they were having a grand argument, and I'd just sit back and listen to them both. And so it was quite a bit of fun to do this. But I had lost my interest in such things or taking up arguments with people, because what had happened to me was a deep emotional wound that resulted in a puncture through the ego nature enough to make me wonder about my divine origins. I didn't have that wording for it at the time, but I looked around at my life, I looked around at all the adults in my life, and I couldn't find within myself anything that I wanted to emulate or anybody I wanted to emulate. And so I began to start a search. What was it that was missing inside of me? What was this huge gaping hole? And it was an inner emotional pain that I could not rid myself of, no matter what I thought of or what I thought of doing in my life. And the first relief came from reading some Eastern teachings, and I thought, well, here at last are some people who are speaking my language. It felt like it offered some hope, some relief to what I was experiencing. And believe me, it wasn't of my own choice. In some ways, I feel like I was dragged on the path, kicking and screaming the whole way. that really what I wanted was just to be satisfied with my life, as other people seem to be. And I often wondered why that didn't seem to be so for me. But that was the case, and at the time I considered it almost a curse that I had this unrest inside my being, that I couldn't find any satisfaction within myself or in my world. And so I had to seek out a road less traveled. But that road less traveled took me to some many interesting places. And now I am very grateful for that inner pain, that inner turmoil that was created inside of me that took me to the path that I eventually came to. So when I first met Mother, I was not prepared necessarily for the language that she used. But there is something about what she said, there is something about how she said it, there is something in the power of her spoken word that drew me and attracted me. More than that, after she had given the talk, she offered to hug everybody at the end, and it seemed to be the custom. So I stood in line, and I was not accustomed to hugging different people at that time, nor was it really the social custom that it has turned into today. But there I was, standing in line, and as I got closer and closer, I felt my heart pounding harder and harder. And as I got up to her, I gave her a hug, and the next thing I knew, I was sitting back in the back seat of the car with the people that I'd come with. And that evening, Mother had spoke about renunciation and letting go of the world. And so the people I come with were having a gay time with that and talking about going to Baskin and Robbins and getting an ice cream and having some fun with it. But I felt as if I were looking at them through a telescope from 1,000 miles away. And I knew that I had been hit by something. Now, I didn't know what it was at the time and that there is even a word for it called Guru Shakti. Now, Guru is that teacher or that one who has come to teach you the truth, to take you from the darkness into the light. And Shakti is the power that it comes through the Guru at that time. Shakti is the power of God within that one. And because of that power, I felt as if I were lifted up in my spirit. And I went through some transformation. Now, I didn't understand the totality of what it was I had experienced in that moment, but I knew something had happened to me. Something powerful and something profound. And I wasn't sure what it was, but I thought to myself, I want to get to the bottom of it. Well, that was in 1974, in March, and you know, this some 20 some years later, 3 or 4 years later, I am still trying to get to the bottom of it. And every time I get to one what seems like a boundary, it breaks through and it opens up into a whole new greater boundary. And so there is no bottom to it, I'm discovering. There is just expanding infinite reaches of consciousness. And that inner pain inside of me has been healed to the most of the greatest extent. Because what I have found within me is that divine presence exists within me. And that I have received conscious access to it. And so my criteria for what I wanted, what I needed from a teacher, was one who taught me the truth, and the other who could help give me some experience of it, and the third who could make me know that I was that truth, has come true in my own life. Now this is the ultimate evolution for each and every one of us. And it's not as if you become something completely and totally different on the one hand. You are, in still many senses, who you have always been. And yet this divine consciousness takes you over and transforms you in a way that you are totally different. Now, if these seem like twin and opposing thoughts, you are right. Because there is a paradox inherent here. When you go through these experiences, you become more and more always who you have forever been. And it is a reminder, it is a deepening of who you are. And yet at the same time, the transformation is so profound, so powerful, so moving, that you become a completely different consciousness. So there is no other way to say it. You know, there are really no words to tell these truths with that can approximate the whole truth. God showed me a vision a little while ago that was really quite wonderful. He was explaining an experience that I had gone through. And when I initially went through that experience, I saw it in one way, as if it were completely His will that I go through that. And then a year later, I saw it quite differently. And I saw that it had been a lesson for my human self, and that it was not of divine origins, and that I had made an error in doing it. And then I came complete and full circle, and I saw that all along it was His will that I do it. Now, from a human standpoint, this seems completely crazy-making and completely at odds with each other. But then He showed me a tall, cylindrical rock. And when I started looking at the rock, I saw it from one perspective. And then I walked halfway around that rock, and I saw it from a 180-degree view different, and a twin and opposing way of looking at it. And then I walked completely around until I was 360 degrees, and I was where I had started. And each and every degree of viewing that rock had its own truth, but no one aspect of that could completely contain the whole of the truth of the vision of that rock. It was only in viewing it from 360 degrees that gave it a complete viewing. In the same way, when we enter into our relationship with God, we see ourselves in one particular way. And when we enter into this path and make some progress on it, we may see ourselves in a number of different ways along the way. We may be lifted up and see ourselves in our God self. We see ourselves in perfection. We see ourselves in our light body. We see ourselves as all and all. And then just as easily, we see ourselves as extremely small, this human self, this human ego, all of its petty concerns, all of its fears, all of its jealousies, and everything else that goes with it. And then once again, we are lifted up into the divine self. And so you see, we go through this roller coaster ride. And the truth is that we have become it all. We are God in human manifestation. So at one time, we are human and we are divine. Now to the human mind, this seems like an unequaled paradox. It seems like something that cannot really be true. We try to separate out our lives and say, this is human and this is divine. This is of God and this is of the world. But in the truth, when we come complete and full circle all the way around, we see that we are God and human manifestation. The difference is that once we have made that circular journey, we know the whole and complete truth. Where beforehand, before we started that journey, we saw ourselves but as a human, without the qualities of the divine. Now when we start the journey there, we start out as the bhakti. We start out with love and devotion, a desire for truth and for God. And as we move our way around that rock of truth, we come around and we come to the place of the yoni. Now the yoni means wisdom. And it's when you are lifted beyond body, beyond senses, beyond all thought of yourself, and you see yourself as completely divine in the pure sense of the word. That is your sat, or your eternal self-being. And then as you continue to progress, you come back down into body consciousness and you bring that purity of sat, or your eternal being, down into your human manifestation. And at that point, you come to the 360-degree view, and you see that you are God in human form. And you have full and complete realization at that point. And that is the parabhakti. Now, that is an extremely rare state to have in this human incarnation. But it is the one that describes what Mother went through, what she attained, and what she came to teach. She taught the wonderful story of Ramakrishna's story of the salt doll. The salt doll is, of course, the doll made out of salt. and went to measure the depth and the breadth and the expanse of the ocean. Of course, as soon as the salt doll entered into the ocean, it dissolved into the sea, and it became and the salt doll dissolving in the sea is where Ramakrishna left it. But Mother continued that story and explained that the ocean reformed the salt doll on the bosom of its crust and delivered it back up onto the seaside in order for it to tell all that God is life and life is God. So you see, there is no dividing up and saying this is of God and this other is not. When you put your mind on God, when God becomes a constant repetition to the brain and the mind, then you become so imbued with that presence. When that presence is constantly with you, then you take all thoughts, all feelings, all impulses as direction from God, and you put yourself on a brand new level of the journey. And then you are taken through all the experiences that are necessary in order to transform this human consciousness to the divine, and finally coming back into full circle, the human, the divine into the human. And at this point you have completed your journey and you have become that complete and fully God-realized individual. So you see, this is the ultimate journey for all of us. There are many who think to travel to distant places and different planets, often to journeys unknown. But this inner space, the inner space of consciousness, is the most dynamic, it's the most alive, it's the most fulfilling trip you can possibly imagine. It completes your total and full being. You could travel to many other places. You could learn great deals of knowledge. You could build great buildings. You could travel to far and distant places and never find the fulfillment, because it is the union of your individualized God self with your universal God self. And this is the greatest thing that is possible for humanity. So when we enter onto this path, we enter into it with a great deal of passion. But along comes that dark night of the soul, and during that time we see everything we held as sacred, everything we held as dear, with disdain. If we find it objectionable, we find it repulsive during that time. And it is especially critical at that time to hang on with everything that we have, to hang on to our search for the truth, to hang on with loyalty towards those teachings that we have learned, and to pull ourselves through those times. If our prayer be sincere, and if it be our journey to be one with God, then we will survive that. And then we will come into the third portal, and that is true and everlasting bliss. Now those who come into this first level are filled with a great joy. They are filled with great enthusiasm, but it is not yet mature. It is not yet mature. So it's not to stop there, but it's to continue on through every obstacle until we find our complete and total union, where there is no more a going in and a coming out, but there is only one continuous, seamless consciousness of which we know we are part and parcel, and we know it to the very core of our being. And then when we are lifted up and we feel that divine bliss through the third portal, then we know who and what we truly are. And we have gone over the top, and then there is no more resistance. There is no more a going in and a coming out, but there is only oneness. But you see, that's not a thing of the mind. That is a thing of the soul, that is a thing of spirit, it is a thing of intuitive knowingness. So the right use of the mind is to put it on God, to sing God's name, to think of God and all the attributes, to think of truth, to think of beauty, to think of bliss and joy, to think of wisdom-guided thoughts. It is to take ourselves away from those habitual thoughts and behaviors that keep us from knowing our true and universal self. And never to let go, never to give up, until we have achieved our goal. And if we do that, we will draw ourselves as surely and as purely to our God self as anything we can do. So let us make that determination deep in our soul to make this number one in our life. It doesn't mean that you don't live in the world and you don't carry on your duties, but you realize what is true, what is the most important for you. You know, even though we may love our work, generally our families are more important to us. And in the same relationship, we may love what we do, we may love our families, and yet our infinite self, the eternal self, is what is most important to us. And that becomes our highest and our truest value. Ramakrishna gave the colorful metaphor. He says, be like the husband who has a lover on the side, who lives his life and works and with his family, but his life, his thoughts are always on his lover. Now this may seem like a blasphemous thing. In fact, they take it out of some of the books that they write about him because it doesn't sound very saint-like. But saints aren't worried about sounding saint-like. It's those who follow after them that want to rewrite history. And this is a great thing. You know, Mother was so honest about her own trials, about her own humanity. And in almost every other saint, you see that they try to write that out of the history books. They want to take away, strip away their humanity. They want to make them more. They want to distort the truth. They want to delete the truth about their total beings, the total package that they were, because they think that their humanity detracts from their divinity. Now, these are written by followers who have not fully realized the truth, you see. They have not come to the full fruition of their God realization. Therefore, they add distortions along the way. Mother Krishnabai was a great example because she demanded and wanted the truth written about everything. She says, tell people I get angry, because I do get angry. But you see, I'm not attached to my anger. And it's not for any lower purpose, but it is for a higher purpose. But nevertheless, I have those feelings. We imagine saints and God-realized individuals as not to have any humanity, and this is not the truth. They are God in human form, and they are fully human and fully divine. The difference is that they have fully discovered their divine origins, and they are at one with it. And that gets expressed through prakriti, or through the outward material nature of spirit. But that sat nature, that eternal self, of which they are part and parcel, is always the core of their being. So then you live life, but your soul constantly heard, hums, unheard by any, God, God, God. Because you know that is the source of your eternal being, and of the truth in your own soul. So passing through these three portals, let us move towards our divinity. And when those difficult and dark times come, and worries howl and shriek at us, let us not be dissuaded from the path. Let us use the cloak of God, Christ, Guru. Let us proceed on in faith, and devotion and love for that one eternal truth. And whatever delusion throws at us, we will shield it off with the thought of hanging on to God, whatever may come. And if we lose our life in that battle, so be it. Better to lose your life than your soul. And then when you come for another incarnation, you will be propelled just that much further towards your own God self. So let us be steadfast. Let us be steady in mind. Let our emotions be ruled by our thoughts. And let us know our soul's inner kingdom. And there we will find eternal happiness and joy, and ever new joy. You know, the mind really can't comprehend that, because we are so used to, through this body, experiencing some happiness, and it lasts for a little while, and then the novelty wears off, and we are off to the next thing. We cannot really comprehend ever new joy until we experience it. And then joy wells up in your being. And with each moment, you experience it as something ever new, ever fresh, ever delightful, never wears away. It is only the mind that tempts us to think so. But the experience and the reality proves it differently. And so this is your true and eternal nature. If you are unhappy with your life, of course you are. Of course you are, until you are fully anchored in the divine. So let each restlessness, let each inner urging be one for God, until you find yourself totally transformed and you know the truth of your own being.
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of thy glorious presence
in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet
and surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Ooh.